I'm joined in the studio by Alan Minsky, the program director here at KPFK, who has been listening in on the speeches preceding the president's. And at the moment, we have Governor Jan Brewer is speaking, the governor of Arizona. And I believe the president is going to be on in a minute or so from now. Alan, rather than go to Governor Brewer's speech on the editorial assumption that it won't be particularly interesting, what is your take on what's happened so far?
Well, the young man who spoke before, who'd worked in Representative Gifford's office, who's a student at the University of Arizona, was a very touching and beautiful speech that occurred came off of the podium and was embraced by Barack Obama. It's a very very dramatic event. And, of course, historically, a lot of people are looking at today and drawing a parallel between President Clinton's talk after the Oklahoma City bombing. And I just am curious as to whether this can be the beginning of a similar type of rebound, not because Barack Obama might not capture this particular moment right. What he says tonight might be embraced. But remember that Bill Clinton and the comeback that Bill Clinton made, you know, all speaking in terms of, you know, the career of this particular president, Barack Obama, versus the career of President Bill Clinton after he was trounced in the off-year elections in 1994, the midterm elections in 94, the Oklahoma City bombing occurred in 95, and then this was part of his comeback. You know, the staring down of Gingrich with the shutdown of Congress. People really should.
By the way, can I just interject one brief note? It's worth remembering that the perpetrator of the Oklahoma City bombing was a right-wing American terrorist who believes all of this stuff that the Tea Party have been putting out, this anti-government
well,
stuff.
Well, McVeigh, it's been pointed out.
Not that I'm saying that this guy, that the current assassin, believes anything. If he does, his mental processes.
My point quickly, though, in terms of the relative careers, people shouldn't forget, lest they get too caught up in the day-by-day events here, that, of course, Bill Clinton had an economy that was in a massive rebound mode already by 95. I mean, you didn't really see it in terms of the economic indicators until later on in the decade, mid-decade forward, but it's unlikely in terms of Barack Obama's the immediate future of Barack Obama's presidency, his standing in polls, his popularity, the state of America, how people are viewing Obama. Bill Clinton had a very powerful economy that was picking up in the mid-90s. That's not the case in the middle of Obama's first term. So up next is not President Obama yet, surprisingly.
The head of the Department of Homeland Security, the former governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano. Okay. And I don't know whether we should go to this speech or what, because we're still waiting for the president. He's supposed to be on now, according to the schedule we were given. But that doesn't mean a lot.
She might be introducing Barack Obama, and I suppose we can listen to Janet Napolitano again from the McHale Center on the University of Arizona campus in Tucson.
We know that the violence that occurred Saturday does not represent this community, this state, or this country. At these times, words can fail us. So let us listen instead to the words of the Old Testament. And I will provide a reading now from the book of Isaiah. Comfort, yes, comfort my people, says your God. Speak comfort to Jerusalem and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name. By the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. This is the word of the Lord.
And that was former Governor Janet Napolitano, former Governor of Arizona, now the head of Department of Homeland Security. Now the president of the university is back on, and I'm expecting him to introduce the president. And after the president has spoken, Alan Minsky and I will do a summary, if there's time, of what he said and the impact that we felt from his words. Alan, it looks like he hasn't really serious. Let's go to his introduction.
The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder.
Boy, we're calling them here tonight. So this is not the president. This is the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder. So, Alan, again, we will decide here not to listen to Eric since we heard a little
from the Book of Isaiah.
Book of Isaiah from the previous speaker.
Well, I wasn't really expecting that,
well,
actually,
no,
from the Homeland
it's,
Security.
It's all very nice to get a little bit of the old-time religion, but let's talk a bit about what the president might do. I talked to Ron Suskind earlier about it, that this is a moment to reach out and consolidate his relationship with the center in this country where politics are lost and won. Here we are at a progressive radio station who spends most of their time attacking Obama. So what's your feeling on
Well, I mean, actually, the thing that strikes me that I think needs to be commented on about this, what's happened over the last week, is again to – because I think in the past few days, especially with Palin really grabbing the headlines, the manner in which this is taking place in a state which has just been racked by, you know, this – war over migrant workers coming into the state and the reaction against their presence in the state, which has produced, you know, some of the most hateful racist rhetoric that we've seen in recent memory in the United States. And there's sadly not all that much of a shortage of that already. You know, everybody talks about in terms of the rhetoric of the Tea Party. And SB 1070 hasn't really been a focus of a lot of the dialogue in the mainstream media and even elsewhere concerning what took place with Gabrielle Giffords and Jared Loeffner. And I don't think that can be put too far in the background. And the fact that Giffords eventually was outspoken in condemning SB 1070. So Eric Holder has left the stage now, and we're back again with the president of the University of Arizona.
And hopefully the president of the United States will be introduced by the president of the University of Arizona, because I'm anticipating this speech as Alan is, and I'm sure all of our listeners are. And we're just been waiting here for some time for it to happen. And this, I think, is a small indication of the great expectations that are being placed on this president to turn things around, to almost do the impossible. I was suggesting that he should stand up to what the Tea Party's been saying about him all these years, but he's apparently not going to do that. He's going to talk about healing the nation, which is obviously more understandable, and more appropriate. Still, it's still worth, I think, at least one would hope that the president could put some context on why he's there and what led up to what happened, which has brought all of these people to the University of Arizona, to this memorial. And let's now I go to, I think he's about to introduce the president.
Your hope. Barack Obama assumed the presidency at a perilous time in our history. We are fortunate to have someone with his intellect, his energy, and his heart to lead us forward. Please welcome the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please, please be seated. To the families of those we've lost, to all who called them friends, to the students of this university, the public servants who are gathered here, the people of Tucson, and the people of Arizona. I have come here tonight as an American who, like all Americans, kneels to pray with you today and will stand by you tomorrow. There is nothing I can say that will fill the sudden hole torn in your heart. But know this, the hopes of a nation are here tonight. We mourn with you for the fallen. We join you in your grief. And we add our faith to yours that Representative Gabrielle Giffords and the other living victims of this tragedy will pull through. Scripture tells us there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. On Saturday morning, Gabby, her staff, and many of her constituents gathered outside the supermarket to exercise their right to peaceful assembly and free speech. They were fulfilling a central tenet of the democracy envisioned by our founders. Representatives of the people answering questions to their constituents so as to carry their concerns back to our nation's capital. Gabby called it Congress on your corner, just an updated version of government of and by and for the people. And that quintessentially American scene That was the scene that was shattered by a gunman's bullets. And the six people who lost their lives on Saturday, they too represented what is best in us, what is best in America. Judge John Roll served our legal system for nearly 40 years. A graduate of this university and a graduate of this law school. Judge Roll was recommended for the federal bench by John McCain 20 years ago. Appointed by President George H.W. Bush, and rose to become Arizona's chief federal judge. His colleagues described him as the hardest working judge within the Ninth Circuit. He was on his way back from attending Mass, as he did every day, when he decided to stop by and say hi to his representative. John is survived by his loving wife, Maureen, his three sons, and his five beautiful grandchildren. George and Dorothy Morris, Dot, to her friends, were high school sweethearts who got married and had two daughters. They did everything together, traveling the open road in their RV, enjoying what their friends called a 50-year honeymoon. Saturday morning, they went by the Safeway to hear what their congresswoman had to say. When gunfire rang out, George, a former Marine, instinctively tried to shield his wife. Both were shot. Dot passed away. A New Jersey native, Phyllis Schneck, retired to Tucson to beat the snow. But in the summer, she would return east, where her world revolved around her three children, her seven grandchildren, and two-year-old great-granddaughter. A gifted quilter, she'd often work under her favorite tree, or sometimes she'd sew aprons with the logos of the Jets and the Giants to give out at the church where she volunteered. A Republican, she took a liking to Gabby and wanted to get to know her better. Dorwin and Mavi Stoddard grew up in Tucson together about 70 years ago. They moved apart and started their own respective families. But after both were widowed, they found their way back here to, as one of Mavi's daughters put it, be boyfriend and girlfriend again. When they weren't out on the road in their motorhome, you could find them just up the road, helping folks in need at the Mountain Avenue Church of Christ. A retired construction worker, Dorwin spent his spare time fixing up the church along with his dog, Tux. His final act of selflessness was to dive on top of his wife, sacrificing his life for hers. Everything Gabe Zimmerman did, he did with passion. But his true passion was helping people. As Gabby's outreach director, he made the cares of thousands of her constituents his own. Got the Medicare benefits that they had earned. that veterans got the medals and the care that they deserved, that government was working for ordinary folks. He died doing what he loved, talking with people and seeing how he could help. And Gabe is survived by his parents, Ross and Emily, his brother Ben, and his fiancée Kelly, who he planned to marry next year. And then there is 9-year-old Christina Taylor Green. Christina was an A student. She was a dancer. She was a gymnast. She was a swimmer. She decided that she wanted to be the first woman to play in the major leagues. And as the only girl on her little league team, no one put it past her. She showed an appreciation for life uncommon for a girl her age. She'd remind her mother, "We are so blessed. We have the best life." And she'd pay those blessings back by participating in a charity that helped children who were less fortunate. Our hearts are broken by their sudden passing. Our hearts are broken. And yet, our hearts also have reason for fullness. Our hearts are full of hope and thanks for the 13 Americans who survived the shooting, including the congresswoman many of them went to see on Saturday. I have just come from the University Medical Center, just a mile from here, where our friend Gabby courageously fights to recover, even as we speak. And I want to tell you, her husband Mark is here, and he allows me to share this with you. Right after we went to visit, a few minutes after we left her room and some of her colleagues from Congress were in the room, Gabby opened her eyes for the first time. Gabby opened her eyes for the first time. Gabby opened her eyes. Gabby opened her eyes, so I can tell you she knows we are here, she knows we love her, and she knows that we are rooting for her through what is undoubtedly going to be a difficult journey. We are there for her. Our hearts are full of thanks for that good news, and our hearts are full of gratitude for those who saved others. We are grateful to Daniel Hernandez, a volunteer in Gabby's office. And Daniel, I'm sorry, you may deny it, but we've decided you are a hero because you ran through the chaos to minister to your boss and tended to her wounds and helped keep her alive. We are grateful to the men who tackled the gunman as he stopped to reload. They're right over there. We are grateful for Patricia Mache, who wrestled away the killer's ammunition and undoubtedly saved some lives. We are grateful for the doctors and nurses and first responders who worked wonders to heal those who'd been hurt. We are grateful to them. These men and women remind us that heroism is found not only on the fields of battle. They remind us that heroism does not require special training or physical strength. Heroism is here, in the hearts of so many of our fellow citizens, all around us, just waiting to be summoned, as it was on Saturday morning. Their actions, their selflessness, poses a challenge to each of us. It raises a question of what, beyond prayers and expressions of concern, is required of us going forward. How can we honor the fallen? How can we be true to their memory? You see, when a tragedy like this strikes, it is part of our nature to demand explanations, to try to impose some order on the chaos and make sense out of that which seems senseless. Already, we've seen a national conversation commence, not only about the motivations behind these killings, but about everything from the merits of gun safety laws to the adequacy of our mental health system. And much of this process of debating what might be done to prevent such tragedies in the future is an essential ingredient in our exercise of self-government. But at a time when our discourse has become so sharply polarized, at a time when we are far too eager to lay the blame for all that ails the world at the feet of those who happen to think differently than we do, it's important for us to pause for a moment and make sure that we're talking with each other in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds. Scripture tells us that there is evil in the world, and that terrible things happen for reasons that defy human understanding. In the words of Job, "When I looked for light, then came darkness." Bad things happen, and we have to guard against simple explanations in the aftermath. But the truth is, none of us can know exactly what triggered this vicious attack. None of us can know with any certainty what might have stopped these shots from being fired, or what thoughts lurked in the inner recesses of a violent man's mind. Yes, we have to examine all the facts behind this tragedy. We cannot and will not be passive in the face of such violence. We should be willing to challenge old assumptions in order to lessen the prospects of such violence in the future. But what we cannot do is use this tragedy as one more occasion to turn on each other. That we cannot do. That we cannot do. As we discuss these issues, let each of us do so with a good dose of humility. Rather than pointing fingers or assigning blame, let's use this occasion to expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts for empathy, and remind ourselves of all the ways that our hopes and dreams are bound together. After all, that's what most of us do when we lose somebody in our family, especially if the loss is unexpected. We're shaken out of our routines. We're forced to look inward. We reflect on the past. Did we spend enough time with an aging parent, we wonder? Did we express our gratitude for all the sacrifices that they made for us? Did we tell a spouse just how desperately we love them? Not just once in a while, but every single day. So some loss causes us to look backward, but it also forces us to look forward, to reflect on the present and the future, on the manner in which we live our lives and nurture our relationships with those who are still with us. We may ask ourselves if we've shown enough kindness and generosity and compassion to the people in our lives. Perhaps we question whether we're doing right by our children or our community, whether our priorities are in order. We recognize our own mortality. And we are reminded that in the fleeting time we have on this earth, what matters is not wealth or status or power or fame, but rather how well we have loved and what small part we have played in making the lives of other people better. And that process of reflection, of making sure we align our values with our actions, that, I believe, is what a tragedy like this requires. For those who were harmed, those who were killed, they are part of our family, an American family, 300 million strong. We may not have known them personally, but surely we see ourselves in them, in George, in Dot, in Dorwin, and Mavi. We sense the abiding love we have for our own husbands, our own wives, our own life partners. Phyllis, she's our mom, or our grandma. Gabe, our brother, or son. In Judge Roll, we recognize not only a man who prized his family and doing his job well, but also a man who embodied America's fidelity to the law. And in Gabby, we see a reflection of our public-spiritedness, that desire to participate in that sometimes frustrating, sometimes contentious, but always necessary and never-ending process to form a more perfect union. And in Christina, we see all of our children. So curious, so trusting, so energetic, so full of magic, so deserving of our love, and so deserving of our good example. If this tragedy prompts reflection and debate, as it should, let's make sure it's worthy of those we have lost. Let's make sure it's not on the usual plane of politics and point scoring and pettiness that drifts away in the next news cycle. The loss of these wonderful people should make every one of us strive to be better. To be better in our private lives, to be better friends and neighbors and co-workers and parents. And if, as has been discussed in recent days, their death helps usher in more civility in our public discourse, let us remember it is not because a simple lack of civility caused this tragedy. It did not. But rather because only a more civil and honest public discourse can help us face up to the challenges of our nation in a way that would make them proud. We should be civil because we want to live up to the example of public servants like John Roll and Gabby Giffords, who knew first and foremost that we are all Americans and that we can question each other's ideas without questioning each other's love of country, and that our task, working together, is to constantly widen the circle of our concern so that we bequeath the American dream to future generations. They believed, and I believe, that we can be better. Those who died here, those who saved lives here, They help me believe. We may not be able to stop all evil in the world, but I know that how we treat one another, that's entirely up to us. And I believe that for all our imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as those that unite us. That's what I believe, in part because that's what a child like Christina Taylor Greene believed. Imagine for a moment, here was a young girl who was just becoming aware of our democracy, just beginning to understand the obligations of citizenship, just starting to glimpse the fact that someday she too might play a part in shaping her nation's future. She had been elected to her student council. She saw public service as something exciting and hopeful. She was off to meet her congresswoman, someone she was sure was good and important and might be a role model. She saw all this through the eyes of a child, undimmed by the cynicism or vitriol that we adults all too often just take for granted. I want to live up to her expectations. I want our democracy to be as good as Christina imagined it. I want America to be as good as she imagined it. All of us, we should do everything we can do to make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations. As has already been mentioned, Christina was given to us on September 11th, 2001, one of 50 babies born that day to be pictured in a book called Faces of Hope. On either side of her photo in that book were simple wishes for a child's life. "I hope you help those in need," read one. "I hope you know all the words to the national anthem and sing it with your hand over your heart. I hope you jump in rain puddles." If there are rain puddles in heaven, Christina is jumping in them today. And here on this earth, we place our hands over our hearts, and we commit ourselves as Americans to forging a country that is forever worthy of her gentle, happy spirit. May God bless and keep those we've lost in restful and eternal peace. May He love and watch over the survivors. And may He bless the United States of America.